This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, international health officials discuss challenges including Ebola.
But we're not just fighting a virus. We're fighting insecurity. We're fighting violence. We're fighting misinformation. We're fighting mistrust. And we're fighting the politicization of an outbreak.
That's World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus speaking to World Health Assembly delegates in Geneva. Also, a boat carrying about 50 people in Uganda capsizes and deaths have been reported. And we have the first story in a series on proposed land seizures in South Africa. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Campaigning has ended for Malawi's tightly contested May 21st elections for president, lawmakers, and local leaders. As political parties ready for Tuesday's polls, Vice President Saulos Chilima, who is challenging President Peter Mutharika, has again raised allegations of possible vote rigging, while local media report Chilima is involved in an investigation of a suspicious plane. Lamech Messina reports from Bilentire, saying Malawi's Election Commission on Sunday closed a two-month campaign period that saw mixed views on how parties are performing in the tightly contested race. After repeated attacks, mostly against opposition party members, Malawi's Electoral Commission in February threatened to disqualify any candidate found to be using violence. Commission Chairperson Jane Ansa told VOA this year's campaign period was more peaceful than in previous elections. But even as campaigning closed, fresh political intrigue and allegations surfaced. Chilima claimed Sunday he was informed that the government had hired a former Zimbabwe security operative to rig the elections. The government denied the allegations. Hours later, Malawi police announced they had detained a private jet and its pilot on May 17th. Local media reports claim Chilima chartered the South African plane and it was connected to allegations he plans to rig the elections. Nearly 7 million Malawians are expected to vote. Official results are expected on May 29th. In opening this year's World Health Assembly, WHO General Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stressed the importance of universal health coverage as an essential component in the quest for a healthier, safer, fairer world. Nearly 4,000 delegates from WHO's 194 member states were on hand to hear the WHO chief outline the main health achievements of the past year and current and future challenges. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO in Geneva.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus campaigned vigorously for the adoption of universal health coverage in the run-up to last year's election for WHO Director General. Now, a year later, he tells delegates attending the World Health Assembly that great progress toward achieving national health systems has been made under his watch. He cites ambitious schemes which have been implemented or are in the process of being enacted in countries as diverse as Kenya, South Africa, the Philippines, Egypt, and El Salvador. But he notes universal health coverage is not possible without primary health care. He says primary health care is where the battle for human health is won or lost.
Strong primary health care is the front line in defending the right to health, including sexual and reproductive rights. It's through strong primary care that countries can prevent, detect, and treat non-communicable diseases. It's through strong primary health care that outbreaks can be detected and stopped before they become epidemics.
Over the past year, Tedros says significant progress has been made against many of the world's causes of death and disease. He says a historic milestone has been achieved with the rollout of the world's first malaria vaccine in Malawi and Ghana. He says a new initiative was launched to eliminate cervical cancer, which kills more than 300,000 women every year. He says battles have been won against a number of infectious and non-communicable diseases. At the same time, he notes many emergencies remain to be addressed. Among them, he says, is the fight to contain the deadly Ebola virus in conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. He says the risk of Ebola spreading to other areas remains very high. This, even though better tools than ever, such as preventive vaccines, are available to fight this deadly disease.
But we're not just fighting a virus. We're fighting insecurity. We're fighting violence. We're fighting misinformation. We're fighting mistrust. And we're fighting the politicization of an outbreak.
Tedros notes Ebola treatment centers have been attacked by armed men, and a WHO doctor was killed in one of these attacks. Despite the many dangers, he says WHO and its staff remain undeterred and will continue their work until the job is finished. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dozens of Ugandan football fans are feared dead after a boat capsized yesterday on Lake Albert in western Uganda. So far, police have recovered seven bodies in an accident similar to one just over 2 years ago. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
About 50 footballers and fans of a local team were traveling on the boat from Tofo landing site to Runga landing site for a friendly match when the boat capsized. Zawadi Rundi, a survivor of the accident, narrates the ordeal that happened only 300 meters after departure.
We set off from here. We did not even go far, just even we were near the shore. But due to some wind, like water wave, and with people were scared that due to how the boat is rotating, they could not manage. And the driver, the pilot, tried that it should go down. As he was turning the corner, so the boat lose control.
According to Uganda police, there were some survivors, although about 20 still remain unaccounted for. Fred Enanga is the Uganda police spokesperson.
About 32 occupants survived, those who were able to swim to the shores, and some who were actually rescued by the community and the response teams from police, marines, and UPDF. Yesterday we recovered two bodies that were trapped in the wreckage, and in our efforts this morning, we've recovered an additional five bodies.
While some have blamed the accident on overloading of the boat, Enanga says investigations are still underway. He says preliminary investigations point to failure to adhere to water safety measures.
This is a landing site that was ungazetted. The boats are not neither inspected nor licensed to operate. There is no established management structure in place. There were no life jackets that were being used, which even placed the lives of the victims in a more vulnerable situation.
This is the second accident involving footballers traveling to Runga landing site. In December 2016, about 40 footballers and fans drowned in the same lake while traveling to the same landing site for a football match to celebrate Christmas. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Egypt's interior ministry said today that raids killed 12 suspected militants near Cairo. The ministry linked the militants to Hassam, an armed group with ties to the banned Muslim Brotherhood. The announcement comes one day after a bomb explosion close to Egypt's Giza pyramids outside of Cairo injured 17 people. Medical officials said a bomb by the side of a road exploded near a bus and a car. Security and medical officials provided no information about the citizenship of those on the bus. However, South Africa released a statement saying three of its 28 citizens in the tour group involved in the incident had been injured and sent to the hospital. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and the Interior Ministry did not link the raids today to the bombing on Sunday. The latest attack raises concerns about the country's tourism industry, which has seen business drop after previous terror attacks. In December, an explosion killed three Vietnamese tourists and one Egyptian. South Africa's ruling African National Congress, or ANC, announced last year that it could possibly soon expropriate white-owned farmland to give to black people. The country's white minority still owns most of the country's prime land, a glaring hangover from the years of apartheid. The ANC's pronouncements sparked an outpouring of invective directed at white farmers, with radical groups vilifying them as racists and land thieves. But in the absence of an effective state land reform program, Darren Taylor reports in the first part of a six-part series that some white food producers have quietly been improving the lives of black farmers for many years.
The hectares are increasing, the farmers are increasing, and we build great relationships.
White Afrikaans farmer Yanni de Villiers is telling an agricultural meeting in Limpopo province how his organization, Grain South Africa, tries to help struggling black subsistence farmers.
Those guys are going absolutely nowhere because they don't have title, they can't access finance, and they can't produce. Can they farm? For sure they can farm.
The smallholders are too poor to buy land, so most work tiny leased farms that they can't use as surety to get the funds they need to grow their enterprises. This is where de Villiers steps in. His partners give the black farmers seeds and fertilizers. Agricultural technicians map their lands and analyze soil samples to establish what will grow best. Grain SA now has 8,000 smallholders on its database.
We've got a photo of the guy, his ID number, what training he has done. We've got a whole portfolio, what cattle he's got. We know the kids and the wives' names because we get to those farms, and it's fantastic to build these sort of relationships. And this is
experienced white farmers in the program are mentoring their less privileged black compatriots to help them become better food producers. De Villiers says it started 10 years ago with 850 emerging black farmers who averaged a harvest of only a half ton of maize. That's up to 4.5 tons today.
Now this is progress that you make. You change people's lives, and I think this is why we believe in this system, because we're not just busy developing farmers, we're busy changing lives.
He becomes emotional about his own transformation.
I've been with some of those people, and if you ask them, you know, what have you done with your surplus money? And the one said, I bought myself a bed. Now that woman could have been my mother, and she's never slept on a bed. And they said they buy clothing for their children. They've got a fridge now in the house. And this is how we change our country and make it better.
De Villiers emphasizes, however, that his project isn't about rich whites giving to poor blacks. He says the emerging farmers are helping themselves.
Even these poor families working 1 hectare have to pay in 3,500 rand to be part of this. And then we've got part.
De Villiers says the farmers have an unbelievable thirst for knowledge, with more joining the program every day.
When we opened it for the new planting season, we received 20 million rand into the Grain SA account from those farmers trusting us that wants to participate in the next planting season.
And he adds, growing numbers of white farmers are providing their time and resources to lift their black countrymen out of poverty.
And when you drive with them in their bakkie on the way to the project, they will tell you about the project, and I say, stop, Nettie. Just tell me, what has it done to your heart? And then the guy just stopped, and he starts crying. It was a hard-nosed farmer who never believed that those guys in the black communal areas could come up to a commercial level in terms of those hectares that they got.
Because of this, says De Villiers, it hurts when some brand all white farmers as racists. He hopes that the state notices the good they're doing before deciding whether to take their land away. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Price hikes in Zimbabwe are slowly becoming the order of the day, from basic commodities to funeral policies. The latest increase in the cost of mobile internet that has triggered an outcry online. Reporter Kutsai Zirvinavashi has more details.
The latest mobile internet price hike came from the biggest mobile operator. Thabani Moyo is the director with the Media Institute of Southern Africa. He explains the recent internet price hikes.
The recent hikes in data poses a serious challenge to Zimbabweans. It must be measured against the income net of the people of Zimbabwe. At the moment, a teacher is now earning an equivalent of 10 gig worth of data, assuming that a teacher earns around 450 to 500 RTGS. It means that access to internet and communication becomes a luxury.
One RTGS dollar recently could buy 250 megabytes on Zimbabwe's biggest mobile operator, Econet. Today, that dollar can only get 40 megabytes of data. Moyo says the government should intervene.
We do not want as a country to reduce communication to a luxury, since it is a constitutional matter. The government must move in ensuring that they do not curtail access to information and freedom of expression through cost structures.
Alex Muringani is a filmmaker who has largely relied on the internet to share his content, but says this will affect his trade along with other businesses.
What it does, though, it really affects a lot of business. A lot of people were trading online. You had people were buying and selling online, Facebook, WhatsApp groups. I'm a content creator, and I don't know how I'll even upload content on YouTube. It's really sad that we are going back to the Stone Age.
Moya says higher rates for internet data also hits the media, which already isn't well-funded due to the prevailing economic hardships. He says traditional media has been trying to migrate online, and online publications have been reaching their audience online. All this means very few people will be accessing media content. While the spokesperson for Econet did not respond to queries, the mobile company's representatives are quoted in local media saying their price hikes are inspired by the increasing cost of doing business in Zimbabwe. The government's regulatory board, POTRAS, recently issued a statement saying the price hikes by mobile operators were within the agreed fees, but the Deputy Minister of Information, Energy Mutodi, tweeted earlier that the price hikes, particularly by Econet, was punitive and unacceptable. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
9 miners have died and 20 have been injured in an accident at a mine in northern Burundi. Officials and witnesses reported the incident took place Friday near the town of Kaburare. Red Cross and civil security officials were involved in the rescue operations until Saturday. Days of heavy rains may have played a part in the accident. A local official told AFP that four of the injured are in serious condition. The area is known for the mining of coltan, an ore that produces metal used in electronic equipment. Mining incidents in Burundi often go unreported. Over the weekend, we met Marine Al-Neil, a 26-year-old mental health expert from Sudan living in New York. On December 25th, Al-Neil flew back to Sudan to help with the growing pro-democracy uprising that led to the April ouster of President Omar al-Bashir. The military, however, remains in power. In the last of our two-part report, we hear about her detention with a group of other women and their unexpected release 6 days later. Here again is VOA's Adam Phillips.
Al-Neil was captured inside a home where she and 22 other women had taken refuge from police gunfire. They were transported to National Intelligence and Security Services headquarters. Al-Neil says she remained calm.
I was with a group. It helps keep you grounded when you're with like-minded people.
She says the facility was overwhelmed and understaffed that day. So while the women were harassed, they were not struck. Many young men were not so fortunate.
We saw the officers beating them, saw the officers using creative means of torture, like, you know, you have to squat and jump across the yard.
Al-Neil's group was transferred to Repentance House Prison for Women. She remembers her first impression of the guards.
These people are suffering from serious cognitive dissonance. They're trying to convince themselves that they're not the bad guys. So every time they would bring us dinner or lunch, they would say, "See, we're treating you well." And then just 30 seconds after something like that comes the rape threats and the beating threats. It seems like they're also very conflicted within themselves.
Al-Neil tries to account for those sudden swings between kindness and cruelty.
Perhaps some of them did not know what they were getting into when they first started working with the National Intelligence and Security Services. But you never know, maybe they're perfectly happy with what they're doing. It really puzzles me.
Al-Neil noticed a difference in how the guards themselves were treated. Higher-ranking officers, mostly men, were allowed to go home at the end of their shifts, while the rank and file, all women, were not.
These are women of lower socioeconomic backgrounds. They are mostly women from ethnic backgrounds that have been historically oppressed in Sudan. It reminded us that even within the people who are working for the regime, these dynamics of oppression are still at work. These women, for example, the prison guards, they're not able to go out and demonstrate, but they will be amongst the people who will benefit from a change of the regime.
Did you try to convince any of these women to come over to your side or at least be sympathetic to what you were fighting for?
I think some of my cellmates tried to speak to them, and the reaction they got from these women is fear.
Al-Neil's fellow prisoners were as diverse as Sudan itself.
Some of the women were mothers. We had a lot of engineers with us. Some were students. It was a nice opportunity to get to meet women that I wouldn't have crossed paths with outside of that experience. And although the specifics that the demonstrators are fighting for might sound very different, there are universal values that these people are fighting for.
She says those values, freedom, peace, and justice, are not foreign to anyone, anywhere. Shared values help to create a community of sisters.
There was a lot of laughter, a lot of dancing and singing, because we believed in what we were doing, and we believed that we're doing the right thing. And even though we were in prison for something that we were proud of. It wasn't like getting caught because of a crime.
Of course, she says, they worried about when and whether they would be freed and how their families and friends were doing. After 6 days, the women were told they'd be released. But first, they were interrogated again, then made to sign a statement promising to support the peace and security of the nation.
Which we all found very funny because that's exactly what we were trying to work for, the security of the nation. Like, okay, yeah, you want us to do something that is good for the country? That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to sign these statements and we're going to go out and demonstrate.
4 days later, Al-Neil returned to her job in New York, but she remained in daily contact with her sister detainees. They in turn wrote her name in the corner of their protest signs until she rejoined them in the middle of May. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.